Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
From the halls of assembly, you'll hear a screaming shout. Our love of Indiana is manic and devout. Everything I do, we discuss in unique manner. We won't be satisfied until we hang another banner. Us two goofy guys go by names of Ward and Eric. And as you probably know by now, we're Hoosier Hysterics. Hoosier Hysterics. Hoosier Hysterics.
Hello, Eric.
Hello, Ward.
We are
in a good mood because Indiana just beat Wisconsin. We just watched it. We're recording the intro seconds after the game.
Fresh off of an IU victory. Just not something we've done a lot of this year. Win or tape a podcast after a win. I gotta say, even though it's pointless and it doesn't really mean anything, still feels good, especially when it's against those bitches from Wisconsin.
Powered by ding,
ding, ding.
Evan Martin of Community Cars was in the crowd tonight, as always. Also evacuated from Assembly Hall tonight, not as always. A little extra spice in the Hoosiers' victory tonight.
Yeah, I mean, just a weird game that we'll get to. But first, of course, Community Cars, another satisfied customer, my girlfriend, Holly Crosby. Her car was delivered last night, delivered to her home in Los Angeles, thousands of miles away. She has it. She's happy. Paperwork all taken care of. Couldn't have been easier. She told them what she wanted to spend. They found a car that fit her budget. What more do you need to know? Don't be a jackass. Buy your car from Community Cars. Let's talk a little bit about the game. Weird game. I mean, weird game. I was looking at these stats, Ward. Indiana shot 61.7% from the field for the game. 61.7%. We shot 43% from the three-point line. We shot 66.7% from the free throw line with, for us, that's good.
Average.
Yeah, we had 12 turnovers, which for us has been really good lately. We had too many in the second half. We out-assisted them. They did have more steals than us. We had 7 blocks. They had 0. I mean, we should have smoked them. We also only had 8 fouls called against us the entire game, and 5 of them were on Malik Renew, including the worst foul of the year.
Yeah, but we're not going to dwell on that. We're going to dwell on, first of all, is there any team we hate more over the last 20 years than Wisconsin? No, I really don't think
Purdue.
So.
Purdue.
I mean, okay, but I guess Purdue is just always. They're our arch nemesis.
And Kentucky.
Them and Kentucky. Kentucky, fine. But, like, that aside, all right?
Yes. Take those two out, and I think you're right.
And
yes,
truthfully, we've done better against Purdue and Kentucky over the last 20 years than we have against Wisconsin. So just as far as a bunch of guys whose faces you want to smack with the back of your hand, with the front of your hand. It's Wisconsin guys. And this team is no different. Greg Gard is no different than it was with Bo Ryan. And watching Indiana basketball tonight was an all too unfamiliar feeling of pleasure, of joy, of really excitement. It was just exciting. It was like the players were excited. The crowd was excited. The whole thing was exciting. And I don't.
And the fire alarm was exciting.
It was exciting. It had the potential really to be anticlimactic, to really be like, what the hell's going on? We were having such a game. But as we talked about on Spaces, the momentum was going the wrong way. And it did seem to help stop that, because we'd given away a hell of a lead. And look, we just wanted it more going down the stretch. And I know that's something you probably hate.
I do. You don't know how much Wisconsin wanted it.
If you can't sense it, then you're just emotionally, no.
We made shots and they didn't.
You couldn't tell there was a different energy our team had on the court tonight to other games.
Oh yeah, for sure.
But not compared
to Wisconsin. They wanted it too. They were down by 14 points and they came back and they were in the game.
We wanted it more. We wanted it more. Yeah. That's why we won.
We had the fire alarms on our side. We had the referees on our side. We had the home court advantage. We shot 60%. Khalil Ware had an all-time game, 27 points on 11 of 12 shooting, 11 rebounds, 5 blocks, only 1 turnover, and we won by 4 points and needed everything we could get. I'm happy we won. I'm really happy for these players, like you said. For the team, it doesn't mean anything. Like, right. We're not going anywhere. But right. I am happy for these players. These are good kids. They deserve a little success. I'm really happy that they were able to win this game.
And the crowd, the students. I was like, look at them. God bless those kids. They're still showing up at the game. They're coming back after the fire alarm. I would be one of those students. And even though this season isn't going anywhere for them, they've got this. This is one of their maybe 4 or 5 years as an undergrad going to games at Assembly Hall. And the Hoosiers gave them a hell of a show tonight. And they're all going to go, even though it's a Tuesday, it's a Tuesday at Bloomington after a win, and those students are going to go party their faces off.
Khalil Ware just showed the total package of skills that he has. And I thought he played stronger than he's played in the past.
100%.
He muscled up some shots against those guys dry. He played great in the post, had some post moves. He had some alley-oops. He had jump shots, mid-range and three-pointer. He also had great alley-oop where he finished. He hit free throws. He blocked shots. He rebounded. He showed why he's an NBA first rounder tonight. Like, more than any other game we've seen, he put the full package together tonight. And it was really good to see, because he's a good kid, despite other pundits like making fun of his tattoos. Who gives a shit? The guy went out and played his ass off. When this team could pack it in, let's give them credit.
Yep.
The season is largely over. We've seen that before when teams just pack it in, and they are not. They are fighting through it. They are trying to compete. It's partly why I felt really bad for Malik at the end of the game, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
He clearly thought that his coaches were telling him to foul. He clearly thought that.
Yeah.
And then he told them, I thought you said foul. And the way Woody went after him, I did not like. I did not like that. I thought the game, he's out of the game. What do you think? It was a misunderstanding. What do you think is going to happen right now?
Yeah, seriously. Like, it did. It soured the moment. And look, I think everybody's still real happy walking out of there, except for maybe Malik. Like, and look, he made a huge basket right before that one. We really needed.
Maybe the game. I think it was the game winner.
It was certainly what put us up, right?
I think that's what. Let me just look real quick. I think if you look at the play-by-play here. Was that the game-winning basket that Malik hit? Yes, Malik. It was 70-70. Malik hit the basket. We won the game 74-70. So it was a huge bucket. He made a mental mistake. He thought the coaches were telling him to do something. He's trying to do the right thing. Should he have had better awareness? Yeah, but in that moment, the crowd's going crazy, and you think the coaches are yelling at you to foul. You do it. Woody demonstrably going after him. I just hated it. It just felt icky. I didn't like that at all, especially because we were winning in that game and he didn't put him on the line. They weren't going to the free throw line.
No, that's why it was understandable to me. Like, oh, we've got fouls to give for the first time all season. Malik did not have fouls to give. A shout out to Chris Littner, Chris Litton, good time, Chris Litton, longtime listener who texted me that for Mac, because Mac hit a huge three pointer. And he was like, that was Mac's first clutch three of the year. And we've been talking about Mac always shows up early and throws in a couple three pointers in like the first 5 minutes. But Chris mentioned that, and that was clutch as well. And it just, it was a game where it was so back and forth down the stretch. And after we blew the lead, you thought we might just like lay over and die. But different players were coming up. Obviously, Khalil was a man among boys. Mac and Malik making those plays down the stretch. Leo comes in, does some really big stuff.
Another great blockout by Leo. Did you see
Oh
that?
my God, yeah. He just like rode the guy to the
And it
baseline.
was Crowell. It was their big man.
Yeah,
And he just
he
pushed
took
him
him
out of
on
the
his
way. It was great.
back and took him back into the first row under the basket.
Do you want to talk about Xavier Johnson after you sang his praises at the fire alarm?
But that's not what I did. If no, that's I didn't do that at all.
You said we
If you
would
want to
be
like
better. You said
misconstrue it for better content, we can, or we could talk about what I actually said.
you said we would be a better team if Xavier played all year and we would have more wins than we do.
Yeah, I think we would have won at least two or three more games if Xavier Johnson had been in the lineup all year. That's
Yeah, I
correct.
totally disagree with it. And I will use as evidence Exhibit A what he did after the 10-minute fire alarm.
Yeah, but what you're doing is you're taking a guy who hasn't played this year and extrapolating, well, this is how he would have played all season.
I'll use his first six games of the year when we were playing shit opponents and he was terrible.
The first six games he played in like 2 years?
Wait,
So, yeah, so what I'm saying is.
you can't count any game he's played this year against Xavier Johnson? It's not
No,
his fault?
what you want to do is say this is exactly how he would have played because this is a six-game sample or a
No,
two-game
because
sample.
out of
I'm
50
saying
games
if he had
this.
played 30 games in a row, he would have gotten better.
And I'm saying before this year, he played 48 games for Indiana University. You can look it up too. 24 were good, 24 were awful. He's cost us as many games as he has won.
Yeah,
He's
but
not a good
now
leader on
that's
the court.
subjective, though. I mean, both those things are subjective. I would
No.
probably.
The stats aren't subjective. You can
Yes,
go
of
look. You
course
were.
they are. You can, like, in terms of what's a good game or a bad game, you can
If
say
a point guard has more
24
turnovers than assists, that's a bad game. And
and 24.
not scoring a bunch of points,
We're
that's a
not
bad game.
going to digress and say what's a good game or what's a bad game. What I'm saying is, that's unbelievable to you. We're not going to discuss that part. That's what you want to
I
get
just
into?
don't I think it's I think if a point guard, the leading point guard, like lead point guard on your team has more assists than turnovers and doesn't score considerable points, that's a bad game from a point guard. Yeah,
Yes,
I think that's fairly objective.
this was in 2022.
You can look at his previous two seasons.
Yeah.
Every game he played, half of 48 were good, half of 48 were bad.
Okay, and then how do you extrapolate that to say that means we would have lost more games than we would have won this
No,
year?
I think it would have been even. I think it would have been
No,
the same.
that's not what you're saying. No,
It
is that
is.
what you're saying? That we would have broken even. Like we would have the
Yeah,
exact same
I
record.
agree with you. He would have won maybe a couple of the close games that we lost, and he could have lost us a couple of the close games that we won. Yeah, I think what he giveth, he taketh away because of the turnover prone nature of his game. And I love X. And when he's really good, he can win
Now,
games single-handedly.
I feel like in my heart of hearts, I feel like he would have done more good than damage.
I just don't think guys in their sixth year all of a sudden get better. I mean, I think we've seen what he was. He can be great and single-handedly win games. We saw that. We saw that at the in his first year in the Big Ten tournament run. Unbelievable what he did for us.
I think because he's been so in and out for 2 years, when he's in, he's pushing. And if this guy just had a full season this year with it being, his team, because that's the whole thing that's blown up in our face. If this is supposed to be his team, him running the point for 30 minutes a night, like that was the plan. Whether you agree with that or not, the plan did not work. But
I
I feel
agree.
like if him, especially after what he went through last year, that he would have just calmed down a little bit and been better than he was bad.
Yeah, we will never know. We will never know. Bottom line, we're 7-10 in the conference now. We have three more games. You still have a chance to salvage. It looks like they're finally going on the win streak that I predicted many games ago.
Salvage.
A 500 season. Okay. A 500 season in the Big Ten, which would, by the way, only be the second 500 or better season in the Big Ten that Indiana has had in, I want to say, like 6 years.
God, that is sickening. Well, yeah. And look, if we'd lost this game, we would have been 500 overall.
Yeah, it's true. And now we go on the road for two games before finishing up against Michigan State on Senior Day. There's not a lot for this team to play for from a team perspective in the regular season. Could they go on a magical run in the Big Ten tournament? It's out there. It's possible. I mean, and then you win something. But even if they win out in the Big Ten, there is no path to the NCAA tournament for this team unless they win the Big Ten tournament, period. Doesn't matter how many games they win the rest of this regular season.
I think they all want to show out, so they have a lot of suitors in the transfer portal.
Oh, boy. All right, but back to your point. It's fun to beat Wisconsin. It's really fun to beat Wisconsin. And these players deserve a little bit of success. I'm glad they had that at the home crowd.
We all do, man. This has been so negative. This has been such a drag this season, especially as of late, that it's just fun. And I was, the only bummer was that my children were having their music lessons right next to me, and so I couldn't have the volume cranked up and hear the crowd going crazy, but I was on the inside.
So look, I think we just bask in the victory and a little bit of the negativity that we just went back and forth with. And there's no point in rehashing what everybody is talking about now. Obviously, the elephant in the room is simply, what is the future of Indiana basketball? Will this staff, largely the leader of this staff, Mike Woodson, be the coach next year? We don't know. That's the answer. Until the athletic director tells us that he's our coach next year, and I don't think that would happen until after the season is over, we don't know. So let's just bask in the glory of that game right now. There's no news to report on it at all, so we're not like hiding anything. And we're also going to go to our segment that we love doing with our IU Ventures partners, where we get to highlight an entrepreneur that came out of the IU world and is doing great things. So with that, let's roll it. Hailing from Fort Wayne, Indiana, she attended Indiana University and graduated in 2006 with a degree in kinesiology. Don't ask me to spell it. She then went on into the business world, where she formed a company called Plan Forward, which just recently, within the last 6 months, was awarded $225,000 by the IU Angel Network as part of IU Ventures in their $2 million financing round. It is a really interesting company. It's another example of a Hoosier doing something amazing. We are excited to talk to her. Please welcome Megan Lohman.
Thank you, Eric. I wish all the introductions were that fun.
All right. So let's get into first. You grew up in Fort Wayne. So obviously Indiana was always, I assume, part of your life in some way. How did you get to Indiana, and how would you encapsulate your Indiana University experience?
Yeah, actually, I was 99% sure I was going to Purdue for engineering. I mean, my calculus teacher sent me there for like the Women in Engineering Day. My parents went. It was a whole thing. Did the tour. I mean, I was like signed going to Purdue until I visited IU. And yes, I visited Purdue multiple times. And I'm like, I don't care what major I have to have. The kinesiology, nobody can spell. I'm going to this place, and it is still a big piece of my heart. So, I mean, literally ever since I stepped foot in Bloomington, I knew that's where I wanted to be. And truly, it really changed my life with all the relationships and connections and things. Certainly wouldn't be where I am without IU, for sure.
So let's get into how your life takes you to founding this company. And I will say, and I hope you don't take this the wrong way, Plan Forward is obviously involved in dental plans and dental insurance and dental offices. And you've got incredible teeth. I mean, that is like, you've got great teeth, obviously.
Thank you.
Maybe that was part of what led you there. I've got great teeth. I should be in the dental world. But what actually led you into that space?
We had all these patients that didn't have great dental benefits. And they were like, always mad about what they owed, or they couldn't find a good plan. And so we created this homegrown plan in the practice that I worked in, who also, the dentist is an IU alum, went to IU Dental School. So lots of IU ties there. And we launched this plan. It grew. And from the business side of things, it just really did some amazing things for the practice and save patients money and kind of check the box for dental benefits. And then as things, you know, grew, they became an administrative headache where technology was primed to solve the issue. So that's where I put on an entrepreneur hat and dove into being a tech founder.
You are primarily focused on providing a software, an SaaS system to dental offices that to help manage their workflow, but primarily focused on people that don't have dental insurance that can sign up for this plan so that you kind of remove the need for insurance. And I'm dealing with a medical insurance thing right now, and it is a nightmare. Insurance sucks. And your company is, for the dental side of things, trying to short circuit that crap and make it easy for people to know what they're getting from their services and deal directly with the dental office. Correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Funny you talk about that story. So that's the actual life that I lived for 4 years on the phone on behalf of our patients, trying to get answers on why things were denied or why, you know, like all the denials, even trying to get paid for things that were approved, even if we had a predetermination where they were saying, yes, if this is done, this is what we'll pay. It's like we got it approved first and then they still wouldn't pay. So on the patient side of things, what we do, they're called in-house membership plans, but from a regulatory standpoint, it's direct primary care. So it's like your concierge medicine, where it's a doctor-patient contract and there's no middleman. So our software is just facilitating the subscription management. So like any subscription you're part of, all the notifications, hey, update your payment, you know, all that stuff, your renewal's coming up. And then the office can, you know where everybody is in their plan year and see who's used what services, see what's remaining, all that stuff. So it does help all of those, you know, the office manage this. But on the flip side, so many patients are paying for dental insurance plans. First, you know, kind of PSA, if you are paying for a standalone dental insurance plan, don't just go to your dentist and ask for a discount. I mean, if your employer is not paying your dental insurance premium, then it's not worth your money. Just pay out of pocket for the stuff you need. And most dentists will give cash or uninsured discounts, or they'll have a membership plan in place.
Megan, you're talking to either an entrepreneur or a potential investor who from either direction wants to get involved with IU Ventures. What's the elevator pitch you'd give them about how your experience has been with IU Ventures and why they should get involved?
There is such a variety from an investor standpoint. I mean, there are all different types of companies and opportunities and founders with amazing ideas pitching them. And the hardest part, especially if you have some money you want to invest and you don't necessarily know the questions to ask or how to evaluate a company and whether the deal terms are right or the market is right, they're going to help you with all of that. So just being part of the angel network, they filter, you know, they scrutinize the companies, they put you through a rigorous process, due diligence process, before they put the company in front of you to even listen to their pitch. So all of that work is done for you. On the entrepreneur side, they, like I said, I was talking to IU Ventures and I've known about them since 2019 and they invested in 2023. So 4 years, timing wasn't right. We were too early. The numbers didn't make sense for them or for us. So it's not a one-time shot kind of thing. It's a relationship. So if you get in front of them and you talk to them and they give you feedback, you know, take the feedback, but don't hesitate to reach back out if something changes in the business, because timing might change. And if you do get in their process, their team is rock solid on getting you prepared to pitch. They know what the investors want to hear. They know what they need to hear. And it's just a really great process to like get you well positioned to take investment.
Great. Founder and co-CEO of Plan Forward, IU grad, kinesiology expert, Fort Wayne native, Megan Lohman. Megan, should our listeners go to their dental offices and demand that Plan Forward be put into their offices if it is not already?
Absolutely. Call me.
All right. And by the way, I had never heard that, like, it's not worth it to have dental insurance. That's good to know. I mean, like, unless you have, like, major problems, right? I would assume.
That's the biggest misnomer. That's when you'll be the most disappointed, because dental insurance is not insurance. You do not have an unlimited insurance to cover oral care. There's a cap. So most dental plans have a maximum benefit. Once you reach that maximum benefit, it's out of pocket on the patient, 100%.
Yeah. See, here's the problem. Insurance companies suck. They all suck.
They rule the world. That's why the tallest building in every city is an insurance company. And yeah, you get a person to answer your question directly when you call customer service.
Yeah, not good. All right, Megan, it was a pleasure meeting you. Love what you're doing. Love that you're a Hoosier. We're foster siblings right across from our cousin McNutt Ward, who was there. And it's just always fun talking to Hoosiers who are doing great things, and how Indiana played such a major role in that. So good luck with what's next for Plan Forward, and we will be rooting for you.
Thank you guys so much. This was fun.
I'm very upset that I'm paying for dental insurance after that conversation. I'm very upset about it.
Well, I've always been upset about it, because I'm always angry about it when I have to pay a bunch of money at the dentist after an exorbitant amount is already taken out of my wife's paycheck for our dental plan. It's like, well, why are we doing this? Turns out we shouldn't have been.
We shouldn't have been. And you know what? It took a Hoosier to tell us that. That's what you get from Hoosier Hysterics. You get a car for free from communitycards.com, and you get advice on your dental plan. How many podcasts are doing that?
None, just ours.
Just ours, which explains the total lack of growth.
Which does not explain why in the world this gentleman decided to join us today. This is a big one. This one's crazy. Didn't see this one coming.
And we announced it on Twitter yesterday, and a lot of people were like, well, that's random. Yeah, I mean, he's one of the biggest names in basketball media. Yes, he's focused on the NBA. There are some connection points with Indiana, but we're basketball fans. And if you're a basketball fan, you know this guy, and he's willing to come talk to us. So let's take a break from talking about what this season has been, and let's talk to an awesome dude who's figured out a way to become the man in his profession, which happens to be involved with NBA basketball.
Nailed it.
And one take.
Here comes our guest. Here comes our guest.
Ladies and gentlemen, he is hailing from Bristol, Connecticut, which just on the surface is ridiculous. And we'll get into that. He is a 1987 graduate of Bristol Central High School. He matriculated at St. Bonaventure, where he graduated in 1991. He, of course, jumped into a world of journalism, where he spent several years at the Fresno Bee and then some at the Waterbury, Connecticut Republican American, 10 years at the Record of New Jersey, where he was twice named the AP Columnist of the Year. He went on to Yahoo Sports, where really he revolutionized digital writing and digital sports journalism. He was there for nearly 10 years, 2 years as the editor of The Vertical, and then he went to the mothership. He went to ESPN in 2017 as senior NBA insider. He has hosted his own podcast. He hosts his own show on ESPN YouTube. You see him all over the place on virtually everything that ESPN does. He was awarded the National Sports Media Association's Sports Writer of the Year in 3 consecutive years, 17, 18, 19. He was the first digital reporter to ever win that award. He is a New York Times best-selling author. He wrote The Miracle of St. Anthony, a season with Coach Bob Hurley in basketball's most improbable dynasty. He was named the 2019 Alumnus of the Year at St. Bonaventure. He was inducted into the Russell Gandolfi School of Communications Hall of Fame. In May 2022, he received an honorary doctorate from St. Bonaventure. I want to get one of those. You think Indiana will ever give us one? I doubt it.
No.
I really doubt it. He is so good at what he does. I just want to read this quote from Jackie McMullen, longtime NBA writer. He's the greatest newsbreaker of all time in any sport. That is a hell of a thing to have somebody like Jackie McMullen say about you. He's so popular. They've named like a proper noun after him. It is, of course, the Woj Bomb. Please welcome our guest today, Adrian Wojnarowski.
Guys, I think you lost your entire audience by the end of that. Nobody is possibly still here.
We've conditioned them. We've conditioned them. They know they can hit that 15-second fast forward button too. How are you, Woj?
I'm great. I'm great. I'm glad to be here with you guys. How are you guys?
Wonderful, and really happy to talk to you. Before we kind of get into how you got to where you are, can you just tell us what's going on now in your life? We're post NBA trade deadline. Obviously, free agency is a little bit off. You've got the playoffs coming up. But what is taking up your time these days?
Working on the St. Bonaventure NIL collective, like you maniacs do for the Hoosiers.
That's right. Okay.
No, we are post trade deadline, and still obviously several weeks ahead of the playoffs. And so, I'm out in LA this week doing our studio shows, and there's always news. News is always coming. There's always injuries. There's always hirings and firings along the way, and you're always preparing and working on and trying to stay on top of what the next thing will be, the next wave of news. And you know, that might be ahead of the draft, free agency. You're always preparing for those sort of kind of tent post moments on the NBA calendar. Those require you're always preparing for those.
Got it.
And when you prepare, I'm guessing you're not jumping onto Wikipedia. Is is your preparation, is your research really about checking in with different people and different places and just keeping relationships and connections afloat?
That's the whole job. It's a 365 day a year proposition. And it's kind of a continuous conversation you're having with folks at all levels of the league. And so, you know, that's how you can do your best to stay on top of not just what's happening, but trying to anticipate what is coming, which is always important, is to be able to anticipate what's next and what's evolving and what might be developing below the surface. Because a lot of these, a lot of news, it isn't always just happening in an instant. It's coming over a period of time. And so that's how I try to do the job.
Woj, you also have a family and you have the opposite of a desk job. Do you ever put your phone on do not disturb the way that Ward does, like 8 times a day, so that I don't bother him? Does do not disturb exist on your phone ever?
No, it doesn't.
And do you ever create a window where you're just not bothered by work and you can focus on family? Or does your wife and kids just know, guys, the phone is an extension of what I do?
Yeah, my wife calls it the fifth family member. Right, we have 2 children. She said it's a fifth family member that's always with us, goes on vacation with us, goes to dinner with us, sleeps with us. It is, that's the best way I could describe it. She's not wrong.
Yeah, I get it.
Is it just the one phone? I think of there like, kind of like there's the bat phone. Is there the Woj Bomb phone? Do you have some
Yeah, it's not as dramatic as people would make it sound. It is really the one phone. I do have a second phone. But if you ask me the number of it, I don't know it by heart. And I don't even have it turned on most of the time. So it really is. I replace it fairly frequently. I don't go as long as the average person might go with a new iPhone. Like, my wife has an iPhone that is years old and it bothers me looking at it. It's so old and run down. She's like, I don't need a new one. And I'm like, I think you could, I think you're due for one, but she's just not as interested in that as I am. But I do try to sort of, probably every 6 months or so, I tend to update it. They wear out pretty fast.
Yeah, well, they kind of built in the obsolescence. They know what they're doing.
Yeah, right. That's right.
All right, let's go back to the beginning, if you don't mind, because I just want to know, like, you can't do what you do without just having a love of basketball. And you grew up, you're born in Bristol, Connecticut. What do you remember about when basketball entered your life? And did you, were you an instant fan as long as you can remember?
Listen, I fell in love with journalism. I wanted to write, and I was a sports fan as a kid, and I played, and I loved it like every other kid who played different sports growing up. But I always wanted to write, and I always wanted I was lucky as a young person that I never really wondered what I wanted to do when I grew up. I always knew. Like, I don't ever remember wanting to do something different than this. I didn't know what form it would take. I didn't know what it meant to be a sports writer at 9 or 10 years old.
Right.
But I read the paper every day, and I knew that's what I wanted to do. So I was always very fortunate. And I think in my mind, always working toward it. And basketball was, I always enjoyed most being in the gym as a reporter. And I came up as a college basketball reporter. I went to a school where basketball at St. Bonaventure, where basketball was really important. And I had some great internships, some really fortunate people, most specifically at the Hartford Current through high school and then college. When I would come home on breaks, they would give me an opportunity in there to learn how to be a clerk in the office. And then they would send me out. I'd get bylines. And I was getting bylines at a pretty young age. I was still in high school. Wow. When I was getting some bylines in the Current, I remember I had a couple bylines in the Hartford Current that I could send with my St. Bonaventure to Bonaventure with my application, which was good because my clips were better than my grades. So I was fortunate in that way. And I just had such great opportunities that people gave me as a young person that I tried to take advantage of to learn the craft. And the best, I always say, one of the best educations I ever had was being in that newsroom of the Hartford Current as in high school and college, and being around all these great reporters and editors, and being able to listen to them talk to each other and read their stories in the computer queue and see how the editors edited their stories. It was such a kind of getting behind the curtain. And then they gave me great opportunities. And so, again, very lucky as a young person that I knew what I wanted to do, and I kept trying to figure out ways to get experience doing it.
Were there any particular journalists or writers that at a young age, their voice, their style inspired you, sort of role models you had early on as you were getting into the game?
Yeah, so many. I shamelessly ripped off so many of my idols, and you know, there'd be a week or two as a young columnist where, you know, I'm just writing like this guy. And then 2 weeks later, my style. And then, you know, over time, you find your own voice. And, you know, my career was very different before I went to Yahoo and just did the NBA full time. I was a columnist. I was the job was different. I was covering everything as a general columnist. Bob Kravitz, who's a legendary Indiana.
Yeah.
Oh, anybody that lives in Indiana knows. You know, Bob was a longtime columnist there, still writing. I still get his Substack. You know, my job, I used to see Bob at all the big events, Super Bowl, World Series, Olympics. You know, I was able to do those things starting at the Fresno Bee for a couple of years. I covered TARC at the Fresno Bee. That was wild. Mm. Andy Katz and I got hired at the same time, same week, to cover Jerry Tarkanian right when he got to Fresno.
Wow. And
then the Bergen record for a decade. And so, the job I do now is not something that even really existed when I was young. And it's not what I would have imagined. I wanted to be, you know, Mark Kriegel in the New York Daily News. I wanted to be Dave Anderson in the New York Times, you know, guys like that who I grew up idolizing. And this path just evolved over time. And so, and I'm grateful it did. It, you know, the move to Yahoo from the Bergen Record, going from a general newspaper columnist to I am going to just be an NBA. I'm going to cover the NBA for Yahoo. I mean, it changed my life. It changed the trajectory of my career, my life. And I had done the Miracle of St. Anthony a few years before that, which I was really proud of. I think this is the 20th anniversary of that book. And Dan Wetzel was at Yahoo, and Dan and I were longtime friends. We knew each other since we were both around UConn as young reporters. And Dan was at Yahoo and kind of got the ball rolling for me there at an opportunity. And I'm grateful to him. I'm grateful for a gentleman named Dave Morgan who hired me there, because I would have continued to have a career, but it wouldn't have been this. And I've loved, you know, I've really loved doing this.
Well, I want to ask you about the, you know, the partnership with Dan, because obviously one of the big tent poles in your career is you and Dan co-wrote the columns that exposed some recruiting violations at UConn back in the day in like 2009. Yeah. And I'm curious about that because obviously, you know, we're obsessed with college basketball and specifically Indiana, but writing an article about recruiting violations, that is a difficult thing for a reporter to do because it takes so much time to really get everything double and triple confirmed and getting the people to talk.
It was a lot. Yeah.
And go ahead.
No. I'm sorry. I'll let you finish, Eric.
I was just going to say, there also is the part of like, you're covering UConn because you came up through UConn. There's also part of like, I'm sure there was some affection for UConn in some way, and you know this is going to cause harm to them. What was that whole just period of your life like, and how did that come to be?
Well, I had covered UConn as a beat writer from right out of college. Let's see, Waterbury for 4 years, and then went to Fresno, back to the Bergen Record, then Yahoo. So this was... I don't know how many years removed, maybe 15. I don't know how many years removed I was from UConn, covering UConn. Mm-hmm. But Jim Calhoun was still there. It was a different point in his career. You know, Yahoo built a lot of the group we had at Yahoo built, I think, a lot of our reputation as an outlet on investigative work. It wasn't just college sports, but folks doing him in other areas. I mean, the staff we had there, you know, Dan Wetzel, who's obviously still there, and, you know, Jeff Passan on baseball, who I've been close to for a very long time. Now we're together at ESPN, and, you know, a number of other, Tim Brown, who is a great baseball writer, Charles Robinson on the NFL, just had some great folks there that, great editors, and really proud of, really a hungry group. And so, yeah, like college investigative, it's different now. There's really no rules anymore.
Right.
Largely, it was different then. And so, it was, those are certainly difficult stories to report out. That's why very few people do them, because it's really hard. And, you know, I think we spent several months on it, maybe closer, I don't know how many, maybe 6, 7, 8 months. I don't remember exactly. Phone records and documents and a lot of traveling around. And I love working with Dan. Dan's one of my favorite colleagues I've ever had. The impact he's had on Yahoo for all of us was remarkable. He, and as a college basketball reporter, he's done everything, from, you know, Don Haskins books to book with Tark, and just a special guy to me in this industry and a special friend. And it was, you know, it certainly was an impactful story at the time. I think we finally reported it right at the eve of the NCAA tournament. It landed in a way that certainly got people's attention. And it was some really proud of that reporting, and really proud of that time I spent again with working with Dan and working with that crew we had at Yahoo. Those were special, memorable years for me.
You ever run into Calhoun after you wrote that article?
I think so. Yeah, I think I've seen him.
Has it been awkward at all?
Not for me.
Fair enough.
When you think about those times and where it's evolved to now for you, how does it just look different operationally from a day to day, from the way you approach the work, you know, going from this in-depth investigative reporting to what you're at least now known for from the outside? It's like, oh, look at this juicy Woj bomb that just dropped on X. What's it? What was that transformation like for you over the years going from that to this?
Yeah, it's very different. And I think appetites of the audience evolve over time. When I started at Yahoo and I was trying to build credibility covering the NBA, I had some sources coming in, people I'd, you know, like I said, I worked in New Jersey, so I knew the guys with the Nets. I knew the guys with the Knicks. I knew Jeff Van Gundy well, and I knew Byron Scott well. I knew Jason Kidd well. Rod Thorne was the GM, and, you know, a couple agents I had gotten to know, but I could count my NBA sources on two hands when I showed up at Yahoo. Wow. But what I did find was if you broke news, people paid attention, and it was a new Twitter was just coming along, and all of a sudden you had a little more of an immediate scorecard or immediate, you know, you could post a story on your, on Yahoo, and I don't know, people aren't necessarily scrolling the site every 5 minutes to see if there's something new. It was different. Twitter certainly had an impact on breaking news. There was an immediacy to it. And it was a little bit of the chicken and the egg, right? To get noticed, you've got to break news. To break news, you got to get noticed. So how do I build these sources? But what I found, it was you build relationships and sources over a very long period. It doesn't happen overnight. And, but yeah, the job, you know, it was more, my career has evolved in a lot of different ways, but there's no question there is an appetite. And I think that what really changed my profession, or for me, my job, it was 2010, LeBron James going to Miami changed how this league was covered. It changed free agency. It changed, you know, as time went on, players trying to team up, wanting to play together.
Right.
That inspired trade demands. Obviously, again, free agency. And there was much more of an audience understanding of the behind the scenes, how it worked, who the GMs were, who the big agents were. It's, I compare it a little bit to like college sports. You would say, especially at a place like Indiana, there's two seasons, right? There's the basketball season, and then there's recruiting.
Right.
And they're two like almost equally important things. And the NBA became that, the season and then free agency or trade deadline. And so
totally,
I just think that 2010 changed the job to me. Mm. And there's just such an appetite for that. And it's not waned. It's not at all. And so, but I would tell you that all the fundamentals that you learn early in this business, and I always tell students this, the platform might change, where you deliver the information might change, but how you, the reporting of information, the gathering of information, the vetting of information, the idea of fairness, the idea of being right, that doesn't change. And that process that gets you to all of those, checking all of those boxes, that can't change just because the delivery of the information has sped up. Just because it used to be, well, I'm not putting this out until the morning paper. I have time to, you know, it's a different speed than I've got to get this up moments from now. And so just because that's faster doesn't mean your process can change. For me, like, I don't want to hit 900 doing this job. I'm not trying to hit 950. I'm trying to hit 1,000. And for me, I don't like getting beat on stories. I'm very competitive. You have to be competitive to do this. I can live with getting beat. I can't live with being wrong. And that's how I try to, that's how I've tried to do this.
One thing that definitely has changed is just the business and economics of media and journalism. And just a personal experience, I was part of the team that created and launched TMZ, which changed entertainment media in many ways. And we were fighting traditional media on that front. And then we had a real problem on our hands when we had the website and then we had the TV show. And at the beginning, you know, we all, many of us were traditional TV guys. and women. And so our thought was, well, if we've got this great story, hold it for the TV show, because that's where we're going to maximize our value, at least we thought. And at that time, the internet and the web wasn't throwing off enough cash to justify blowing the story there. But what we quickly realized is, with the internet, with Twitter coming online, you were going to get beat. So it didn't matter. No one was going to wait till 7 o'clock to watch TMZ. You had to get the story out. What I am curious about is, for you, you know, you break a lot of stories on X. That's a free platform. You are employed by ESPN. Is there ever a conversation with you about holding something so that ESPN can capture the currency, which is breaking stories? That's kind of the world we're in. Is that a struggle that you have to walk a fine line on?
No, it's ESPN does get my breaking news first. In almost every instance, you get notifications. Now, you know, I think there's a world where our notification system here will be faster and more in the moment, but it just happens people look at Twitter first. But our work is filed to almost simultaneously, but there's plenty of times where, you know, I'll give an example, a story Ramona Shelburne and I had last week on the Warrior Laker conversations on LeBron James. I mean, we posted it. It wasn't a tweet. We wrote a story. We posted the story. It was on the site. And then, you know, I posted it to our social media with the story. It was on ESPN.com.
Got it.
And so I think that's I think that can be a little bit of a misnomer, that it's just, I would love for you to have the ESPN notifications on, but you're going to get it there too. Now, from the time I file that to ESPN to the time it goes out in notifications, I think that will be faster at some point. Same for Adam Schefter and Pete Thamel, Jeff Passan, others who do what I do here at ESPN. But I don't think that it's just Twitter's one place it goes, or X, whatever.
Sure.
It goes to Instagram. I'll post on Threads now. You'll get it on ESPN, your notifications, if you have notifications for the NBA or for Sports Center. And, you know, sometimes there's times I can time news around like NBA Countdown or big shows where I might post a story right before I go on air and then go on and build it around a show, which, you know, I could give you some examples of that this season. So I understand what you're saying, but I do think that you're feeding that ESPN monster right along with, but people are very conditioned to be mostly focused on Twitter. Although I don't know how many NBA notifications there are off of our site. It's millions and millions of people get the notifications, maybe 20, 30 million. So it's certainly probably more people than are getting the tweets, but it's just everybody consumes it a little differently.
Totally. It's just interesting how the world has changed, where when you started your career, you had a story, you're like, okay, this is going to break in the paper tomorrow, right?
So I'll tell you, the first story I ever remember on the UConn beat, one of the first stories I ever broke, Ray Allen's commitment to UConn. He was down to, I think, Alabama and Kentucky and UConn.
Okay.
Maybe Kentucky was out, but it was definitely Alabama. And I think I got a hold of him. He was in Dalzell, South Carolina. And I want to say, as I remember, I might have got a hold of him at 6 or 7 o'clock at night and told me, I'm committing to UConn. I'm going to UConn. I called the coaches. I told them I'm coming. You know, the deadline for your newspaper, the last edition is probably like midnight. And then, you know, it's going to come out 6 in the morning, 7 in the morning, whatever it was. I remember saying to Ray, could you not answer your phone the rest of the night? Could you not talk to anybody else? And you didn't know whether anybody else had it until you got the morning paper.
Right.
And in Connecticut, there was a bunch of them. There was one spot in Hartford. I lived in Bristol. I was still living in Bristol then, where I grew up, and I worked in Waterbury. But there was one. There were a couple spots in Hartford where there were like 6 or 7 newspaper boxes. And I used to always hear that Calhoun would send the managers or the office workers down in the morning to get all the papers and drive them back. That was a legend. And there was no internet. You couldn't log on and get it, or there wasn't newspapers on the internet. And I do remember that next day getting up early, driving to Hartford when the papers came in to see who had it. And that's how different it was. And that was what, 91. That was probably 90, maybe 93, maybe 92 or 93, right around.
And were you the only one who had it that morning?
I don't think so. I think somebody else had it. You know what used to get you then was the Bob Gibbons. You guys are going to know this.
The Bob Gibbons
900 number.
Yes.
Where
yes.
It was like a dot, like he must have made a fortune off of that thing, because
oh my God.
He would talk really slowly. He had that slow Southern drawl, and he would give out recruiting news. And, you know, you hope that the info you wanted was first and not 10th on his list, right? He'd be stuck on the phone. But yeah, it was very different.
Different world. Hey, yeah. Another quick story that I think you'll appreciate. Do you remember George Michael's sports machine?
Sports machine, yeah, out of DC, sure.
So my old boss, one of the guys who kind of taught me the entertainment business, worked for George Michael early on in his career. They would rent different apartments in LA that had different television providers so that they could videotape different networks that were on the different providers for highlights. And then his job was to go from apartment to apartment and gather up the VHS tapes and the tapes to record it and run them into the studio. That's how different it was. Yeah. And it wasn't that long ago.
It wasn't that long. Maybe it was that long ago. We don't want to admit it was that That's long true. Ago, but it was.
Do you...
Woj, you recall there, that was one of your early breaks you were getting with Ray Allen. I mean, there's been a million at this point, but can you pick a favorite break that you got to something you were able to communicate to the world before anybody else? Is there a number one for you?
I do get asked this. I honestly have never given it any thought. I only... The only one I really care about is the next one.
Hmm.
It's the one I really care about. It's the next one. And listen, there's a lot of different work that I'm really proud of. It wasn't always just a scoop or a transaction. There were a lot of different kinds of journalism I've done in my career that I'm super proud of. I'm super proud of Miracle of St. Anthony and that book and that year that I spent with them. You know, Indiana was a part of that. That's where I got to know Dusty May that year, because Dusty was on Mike Davis's staff. And I think maybe somebody had left and he got moved up. He wasn't on the road and he got moved up that spring. And I remember he came recruiting. There was a young guard at St. Anthony that they were involved with a little bit. And that's where I met Dusty May, and I've known Dusty ever since. That was, again, 20 years ago. But just the challenge of writing a book. I had great material because I had a great subject matter and Bob Hurley and St. Anthony's and a really interesting group of kids and nuns at the school. And I felt such a responsibility to tell that story well. And I there were a lot of sports books as a young person that inspired me. And I sat and read and made me want to do this for a living and seemed untouchable to me. I could never do this. And it's still a great thrill for me. Maybe my greatest, to walk into a library or a bookstore and see the Miracle of St. Anthony on the shelf next to my idols, Mark Kriegel or Alexander Wolf. I remember, if you look in the backdrop on my home backdrop on TV, you'll see like a St. Bonaventure pennant. You'll see my high school, Bristol Central High School, the writing initiative that we've put together since I've come back to ESPN, a little insignia for that. And one of the books there is Raw Recruits by
Alex
Wolf and Armin Kintayan.
That was the Bible.
I remember getting that book either, I don't know if I got sent to me or, but I remember, I don't know what year it was at St. Bonaventure, but there was a lounge at the end of our hallway. And it was right past Mike Vaccaro's room. Mike Vaccaro's the great columnist of the New York Post. You know, Mike and I went to Bonnie's together, and he's the godfather of my son. It was right next to where I knocked on his door as a freshman and said, hey, I want to you know, I want to write for the student paper. I heard he was the editor in chief, and I went and knocked on his door like the first or second day that I was at Bonaventure. Wow. And I remember sitting in that lounge with these really old kind of decrepit, you know, those little cushion chairs that you would sit in there. And there was like a TV up on the wall that had like three Buffalo channels. And I remember sitting for like 7 hours. I never got up. I read that book in one sitting.
Wow.
And it was just the reporting, and it was like this whole world. And, you know, I wanted to be a college basketball reporter, and it was the underbelly of it all. And it was fascinating. And so it pushed me along. And I remember writing a letter to Alex Wolf when I was at Bonaventure at SI. And I remember going to my, you know, in college, right? You go to your PO box. It was the highlight of the day.
Yeah. So
you had it in the mail. And then you check back. You didn't have any. You check back 45 minutes later in case maybe they were late with it that day. But I remember pulling out a letter from Alex Wolf, and he wrote me a 2 or 3 page letter with advice and telling me how he had covered, as a young reporter, I think at Princeton, he had covered maybe Princeton and Bonaventure in Rochester, New York, at a holiday tournament or something. But I remember some of the details of it, but it was such a thrill for him to write me back. And it's always stayed with me. And it's always reminded me of the best I can do is, you know, any young people who, you know, you don't get letters anymore. It's funny. Even at your office, it's less of a thing, but certainly
you
any
get DMs, people, you get DMs and you get emails. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, but I've always tried to take time the best I can. In fact, I met with a bunch of IU students, Mike Wells, who's been a friend of mine for a long time, obviously covered the Pacers and then the Colts for indie papers for ESPN. And now he's teaching at IU. We did the podcast on All-Star Weekend at the Vogue Theater in Indianapolis. We had Tyrese Halliburton, Grant Hill, and nice. Mike brought up, a dozen or so of his students from IU and left those guys tickets. And we spent some time after the show just talking. And
that's awesome.
I'm amazed at the young people coming up in this business. They're so further along than I was and we were, and they've been maybe exposed to a lot more. And it's exciting to see. I know IU's got a great journalism school, and they produced a lot of really talented people. And there doesn't seem like there's any shortage of them still there now.
It worries me, though.
It just seems to be a tradition in sports journalism to pay it forward. As a young kid, I actually did play-by-play for my high school basketball team, and Marv Albert was my absolute hero. And after a Pacers-Knicks game in the Eastern Conference Finals, I found him after the game, and I was like, Mr. Albert, could I please interview you before the next game? Because we knew they were coming back. It was going to go to New York and then come back for at least the game six. And he was like, sure, sure. But we missed each other before the next game. He was in a production meeting. My dad ran into traffic driving me down there. So I faxed him like a 4-page letter, because this is like 1994, saying, yep. So sorry, we missed you. I'm so sorry. And it was like 4 months later, and he was getting ready to leave his office for the summer, and his secretary called from Manhattan and was like, yes, this is Marv Albert's office calling for Ward Roberts. I'm like, yeah. She's like, Mr. Albert would like to call you in a half an hour. Is that okay? I'm like, yes. So I ran to the local radio station where I worked. I got a tape recorder. I rode it back home on my bike, and he proceeded to have an hour-long conversation with me about journalism.
That's awesome.
I mean, it doesn't get any better than that. I mean, it really doesn't. And I was that kid. I was that kid too. And I never imagined. I don't think there was anything. I always tell young people, there was nothing special about me that you would have thought I was going to have any career different than anybody else was having. And I benefited from so much good fortune and so many people who helped me along the way, who mentored me, who gave me opportunities. And listen, when I was an intern at the Hartford Courant through high school, college, if they had offered me a 40-year contract to sign with the Hartford Courant to cover, there was a gentleman named George Smith who covered local colleges. George was a very tall, distinguished guy. And I thought he had the greatest job in the world. He'd cover UConn football, Yankee Conference football in the fall. He got to go to like Orono, Maine, Durham, New Hampshire, play BU in Boston. they were overnight trips. He got to go stay overnight in a hotel and cover a football game. He covered a University of Hartford basketball in the winter, the NAC, the North Atlantic Conference. And then in the spring, he did like whatever college baseball tournaments were going on. The Big East baseball tournament would be in Bristol, or Eastern Connecticut State would be going to the Division III World Series in Salem, Virginia, and he'd get to go there. And then in the summer, it'd be like American Legion baseball regionals. If you said, hey, you can have this job for the next 40 years, I would have signed away my life. And so everything, you know, everything that has happened has been, I'm as surprised as anyone.
Just to ask you a couple questions, some interest in the NBA and the kind of current state of things as it relates to college basketball. The one and done rule is obviously something that comes up all the time. It's completely controlled by the NBA, whether or not that ever changes. For a while, it seemed like there was a movement to go to like a 2-year or making it an age restriction at a certain point that would almost force people to stay in college for 2 years or push more guys to go to, you know, the overtime elites and those things. Where is that conversation at in the NBA? Is it even on the agenda?
I think it's, I don't want to say it's dead, but it's certainly been, I think a lot of us thought it was going to get dealt with in the last collective bargaining agreement. And what changed, I think, was it used to be that the union wanted just an open system where players could just leave. We go back to the system where players could come out of high school
right
to the NBA. Now they can come out of high school and go to the G League and then be in the following draft, right?
Yep.
Or go to the G League Ignite. And the NBA wanted, as you suggested, Eric, the multiple years, perhaps. And then the NBA went to, okay, we're fine with the 1-year rule. And the union, we're fine with actually, I should say, going, allowing players in out of high school. The union, I think, became a little less agreeable to that idea. I think that, listen, there's a lot of veteran players in the league, overwhelming number, who know that they'll be out of the, they may be out of the league when you open it up, and you all of a sudden you're using more roster spots for developmental players who are not ready to play, and that knocks veterans at the end of the bench off. I think that was part of it. I think the fact that there are now so many more opportunities now to make money.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you know, if you're Zach Edey, I don't know. I have no idea what he's getting paid in NIL or what he's getting from NIL from Purdue. But if Zach Edey was going to be a two-way player, let's say last year, his standing in the draft last year is much different than it appears that it's going to be this year.
Right.
With the improvement he's made in his body, and all credit to him. But if you were going to be a two-way player, you know, that's like a $500,000 a year salary. Adama Sinogo from UConn, like, he could have decided, hey, Donovan Klingon's coming behind me, and certainly he needs an opportunity to play this year. Adama Sinogo could do what Hunter Dickinson did, right?
Yeah.
Dickinson
went to Kansas. Yeah.
Went to Kansas. I mean, I think he's probably getting more in NIL than what he'd be getting on a two-way. And so I think that's changed it. But we're at a place now where it's not really a debate anymore. I think the rule in its current state is the way it's going to be, especially when they did not address it with this new CBA. I think it's kind of where it is right now. And, you know, for better or worse.
Yeah, that seems to make sense. And I do think, because NIL has changed it as well, and there is the opportunity now that if guys want to, they can go and play professionally. They just can't be in the NBA draft. They could just go to one of the like prep teams.
Right, right. I mean, you saw when like LaMelo Ball would and RJ Hampton went down under.
Yeah.
And that kind of was a little bit what was starting to inspire the G League Ignite. Adam Silver said our scouts shouldn't have to go to Australia to see American players in a post-grad situation or a professional situation. Players should have an opportunity to be able to stay here. And you just heard Adam Silver talk about it. Has the G League Ignite maybe overstayed its necessity, because you know, there were really, you could make pretty good money going in, and the league wanted to be able to have some control over player development and get players into their system. And they've done it. You know, I think there were some years where they did some really good job with guys. The Ignite has really been, Jonathan Givony has really, at ESPN has really chronicled it this year. They've had a lot of struggles, and all of a sudden you go, well, why do we need G League Ignite paying a player $500,000 for the year? And and that opened the door. He could get a Nike deal. He could get endorsements when he could just go to Indiana and do that. Right. And so I think the league's reevaluating the Ignite and whether that continues to be something that's, because they are investing a lot of money in it. And is it needed anymore?
I also use the Zion Williamson example for kids thinking about it. Like, if Zion Williamson had gone to G League Ignite at that point, he doesn't get that endorsement deal that he gets coming off the back of his one season at Duke. The college game still provides an incredible platform for guys to become stars. And that, while the NBA has, you know, through several collective bargaining agreements now, and you know this better than anyone, they have figured out the rookie pay structure and where you're slotted in the draft and all that. That money's locked in, but endorsements aren't locked in. And if you become a star in the college game for 1 year, if you make a run in the NCAA tournament and you become a national star, or over the course of the 4 or 5 month season become a star, you can make so much more by your star power than you could if you went to G League Ignite, where you're going to play in obscurity for many months.
You're exactly right. And college basketball, for all it still provides that. And you're right. Zion Williamson going to Duke, you know, has played a huge part in the, not just him being picked number one overall, but the attention that he.
Totally. The star, the star of him. Star, yeah.
There's no question. And so that continues to be true. It's still a chance to play on national TV multiple nights a week and be a part of March Madness. There's no question that it has value. And, you know, listen, there's just some guys who they decide they don't want to go to school and they want to do this, and that's fine. What is great to me is there's an option for everybody and what they want, and what was best for Zion Williamson might not be best for somebody else. And for lots of reasons. And so I just think it's really good that it's a system where you have choices, and not every choice is for every person. And, you know, having the Ignite, having college NIL, if you want to go, there's still players. If you want to go to the, you know, if you want to go down under to Australia, you can do that. And you're seeing European players going from there to the Australian, you know, European players are in the G League Ignite who are coming here and learning the American game, or learning the NBA game here. So I think at the end of the day, it's not one size fit all. And I think you've got guys, I think the world's always better when everyone's got some options.
Yep.
Woj, as you know, we're an Indiana basketball podcast, but Indiana University basketball isn't a lot of fun to talk about right now. So I do try to bring the Pacers into the conversation as much as possible these days. I was hoping to get your expert insight on the monster they're building there around Tyrese. And you'd mentioned earlier about how the game has changed. And I think not necessarily for the better, a lot of times for smaller market teams like Indiana, even though it's a basketball ravenous state. And I just wonder, what do you think of what the Pacers have been building here the last couple seasons? And is it something they can keep together and see maybe some real fruits in a deep playoff run, whereas it seems in the last couple generations, like post Reggie Miller, it's just too hard to keep enough star power in a small market to take it all the way.
Lord, I love what the Pacers have done, starting with the Halliburton trade, the trade for Pascal Siakam, the way they've drafted so the young players they have who they're developing. Rick Carlisle has been outstanding. Kevin Pritchard, Chad Buchanan have done a really good job of retooling this. It's really rare that you can trade at whatever he was, 22 years old, 23 years old, trade for an all-NBA guard who isn't all-NBA yet, right, who's on his way to that. And it was such a unique trade with Sacramento. They had two great young point guards who, as Halliburton said to me once, we were better away from each other than we were together. Hmm. It wasn't a knock on either guy, but they were both players built to have the ball in their hands. And so Sac needed a big. They got an all-star big in Sabonis. They had no size. They had no other way to address it. They tried every other way. They had to trade Halliburton. And the team has – they've done great. And so – but I think in Indiana, what benefits Indiana, and I think the Siakam trade to them reflects this, the new collective bargaining agreement with the league and the new salary cap is designed to spread the talent around the NBA, that it makes it just way more difficult and punitive in lots of different ways that your audience probably doesn't care about. But the idea of having like three max players is almost dead if you want to have any kind of depth around them. And so what the goal was so that Golden State, the Clippers, the Nets, go through the teams that did not care about luxury tax. They would spend it. They had really rich owners. No matter how much luxury tax you charge them, they were willing to pay it. And now it's not a question of paying the luxury tax. It's if I am in this quote-unquote second apron of the salary cap, I lose my draft picks. I lose the ability to sign players on buyouts. I'm limited in the kinds of trades I can make. I am going to make it so hard for you to make any kind of move. You're not going to want to be over that second apron, which keeps spending down, which is what the owners wanted. And so instead of Pascal Siakam getting traded to, let's say, Golden State, the Clippers, the Lakers at the trade deadline, he had to go to a place that could, number one, afford to re-sign him. Number two, that could fit him into a cap structure. And number three, Siakam had a lot of say in that scenario, because if the Pacers don't think Pascal Siakam wants to re-sign with them, they're probably not trading three first-round picks. Right. They're probably not giving up a very valuable contract in Bruce Brown unless they have a level of confidence that that player wants to be there and wants to re-sign. And a part of why he wants to be there is playing with Tyrese Halliburton, is seeing the style of play and a roster that can be built around those two. And
Turner,
and
so all
too, those factors benefit the Pacers now and smaller market teams. So they can keep it together. Yeah.
It's like it's exciting. They are for sure exciting. I want to ask you, obviously, because we're college basketball junkies and we focus on Indiana, we spend a lot of time talking about AAU basketball and recruits. And AAU and player development have come under the crosshairs recently, as I've seen a lot of articles about the influx of European talent and international players in the NBA, displacing a lot of American-born players, and just how the systems are so different overseas in player development and skill development versus what we have here. What is your sense of kind of the current conventional wisdom on player development for American-born players? Is this a trend with international players replacing American-born players that cannot be reversed? Or where is that at?
Well, part of it is that as basketball grows around the world, there's just more places in the world where players are coming from, and including Africa. And you're seeing that the grassroots growth and the coaching, and, you know, Masai Ujiri, the president of the Raptors, you know, his program, Giants of Africa, putting courts and coaching all over the continent. And you are seeing players, again, like it's a whole new avenue of really, there's been players there before, but there's more of them. Pascal Siakam is one of them. He's a player who went to the NBA's Basketball Without Borders and showed up there because his sister lived in that area and he hadn't been able to, I think this was a story. I think he told me this on a pod once, that he just traveled to go see a family member there and then showed up and played and got hooked and was a big kid and ends up at New Mexico State and picked at the end of the first round. And now he's an all-star because of development. So part of it is the structure and the teaching and the system overseas. that is more based on skill development than our AAU, which is just playing games and just running up and down. And we're playing more games than we're playing, than we're having, than we're in the gym practicing. And yeah. I just had dinner the other night with a friend of mine who works for an NBA team, who played about a decade, 11, 12 years overseas, good American college player, who went overseas, played in, Spain and some big places over there, Russia for a time, and works for a team now. And we were having that conversation, and that for that very, those very examples we're talking about, that whether it's Europe, for example, that it is just a system that allows players to develop, more fully develop their game. That doesn't mean there aren't players that are here who are extremely skilled, who haven't been well coached. Of course there are. But it's a combination, I think, guys, of, again, more places around the world where there are more good players coming from. There was 20 years ago, it was mostly just Europe or Eastern Europe.
Right.
And now it's, again, it's more parts of the globe. And so, yeah, the challenge for American basketball is to keep up with that. And I don't think the NBA game is going to get less global. I think it's going to keep getting more global.
I know. And I think the other problem is that in the high school side of things, you know, there's money to be made in games, you know, yeah. The Peach Jam and all those big tournaments in the EYBL circuit. There's no money to be made in practice. And I agree with you. It's like some of this you can't control. It's just numbers. It's population. America has 350 million people, and the rest of the world has 7.5 billion. So if there's just more investment in the rest of the world, there's just more opportunity for people to come from there. Then there's the European international model seems to be focused more on practice as opposed to play. And in America, we're all play and not practice. And if that doesn't change, it seems like that just accelerates the ramp up of international mm-hmm. players ultimately to the NBA.
No, it's exactly right. And so it's not new. This is not a new conversation. This has been going on. But you see, watch this year's draft and see where, especially this year's draft, and see where the players are coming from. Guys, it's not going to be the Big Ten, the Pac-12, the SEC, the Big East, right?
Yeah.
Of course, there'll be some. There'll be some top players. And next year's draft is a great American draft, 2025, some tremendous players. But this, I think, especially is going to be a draft where you're going to see there might be as many non-American college or non-American G League Ignite, maybe non-American born players. I don't know what the record is. I don't know what the most in the first round is, but I bet you this one's going to challenge that.
Wow.
Woj, if you could go back in history and watch, I'll make it a little easier for you. It could be either any one basketball game or one basketball team that you didn't get to see play in person. Who would it be?
I'm going to tell you exactly what it would be. Never asked that question before, but I went right to it. 1970, East Regional Final, say Bonaventure Villanova.
Nice.
Bob Lanier's on the court with about 5 or 6 minutes left. We're up 30 on Villanova, steamrolling to the Final Four to play ultimately play a UCLA team that was the year between Bill Walton and Lou Alcindor. Steve Patterson was their center that year. This was the year to play UCLA. It was Sidney Wicks and some great players, you know. And Lanier's in the game late, and Chris Ford, the former Celtic guard and
coach.
Celtic coach, yeah. late great Chris Ford, ends up rolling up on Lanier's knee and blows his knee out. Ugh. And they're carrying Bob Lanier off the court, who is the national player of the year in 70. Well, him and Pete Maravich, I guess, right? Mm. But number one pick in the draft, kid from Buffalo, goes to the, you know, local school down the road. And the Bonnies lose them. We go to the Final Four and play Jacksonville in the regional, in the national semifinal, which had Artis Gilmore and Pembroke Burroughs, 2 7-footers. And I think Bonaventure didn't have a starter bigger than 6'6", 6'7", lost like 92-85, would have drilled them with Lanier. And then we would have beaten UCLA. So what I would have done is, my point is, I'd go back to that game and I'd be standing behind the bench screaming at the great Larry Wiese, our great coach, Coach Wiese, get him out of the game. Get Bob out of this game. Anyway, that's what I
love.
Do.
That.
That is the game I'd go back to.
That is awesome.
Yeah. Great answer.
You may not be able to answer this because you may not have been focused, turned your focus yet to the NBA draft in full force. But Indiana's got a kid, Khalil Ware, 7'1" center, skinny guy, has a shot, you know, play, can pick and pop, great length, rim protector. And there's a lot of debate on what his NBA prospects are. Have you heard anything about him? The conventional wisdom was he's a first rounder, maybe late in the first round now. Any word on him?
Eric, I could give you some bullshit answer. I have no idea.
All right, good.
I haven't. It's just not a guy yet on my radar. He will be. I'll be loading up with Jonathan Gavoni, certainly ahead of the draft, and my NBA people. But I've not really been able to watch Indiana this year, and I haven't heard a lot of discussion. I haven't heard any discussion, like, but my ear's not to the ground necessarily on that yet. So I'm not going to give you a bullshit answer.
I appreciate it. Truth is, all discussion about Indiana basketball has been real negative this year. So
yeah, I know.
We could tell that you hadn't been watching Indiana basketball because your eyes weren't bleeding.
All right, but I've got a backup question. You're a Bristol, Connecticut guy. I assume you're a New Haven pizza guy. Do you have a favorite New Haven pizza? And does New Haven pizza make it into Bristol at all? Is there any trickle down?
I know that's a great question about New Haven pizza. And I've spent time in New Haven covering any number of things in my early days. I know the famous pizzas out of there, I don't think that I've ever tried any of them. I don't have an answer for that.
Really? You've never tried Frank Pepe's pizza?
No, I don't think I've ever. I'm pretty sure I never have.
Wow.
I wish I mean,
you're so focused. You're so focused.
I went to Main Street Pizza in Bristol in Mafali's Plaza down the street from where I grew up. I liked their sausage pizza, but that's the best I can do. That's a good question. But
are you a Jersey pizza guy now?
I mean, we've lived in Jersey longer than I lived in Connecticut, which is amazing.
Wow.
But if you ask me what the famous spots are in Jersey, I don't even know.
All right. Last question. What's more fun for you, NBA trade deadline, NBA draft, or NBA free agency?
None of it's fun. What's less torturous?
Let's do it. All right, let's go with that.
What is less torturous? Draft is the worst. Because there's a bunch of things going on at once, right? There's trades happening. You're on live TV and you can't get up to go to the bathroom. I'm on that stage in Barclays Center in Brooklyn and there's nowhere close. You can't get up. You are on there from 5 in the afternoon. You start doing Sports Center hits till midnight. The only thing good about doing the draft the way we're doing it this year is, you know, you don't have I would rather still just do it in one night, but they're going to do the two rounds.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
It gets you up into the bathroom at some point sooner than you would with two rounds. So I would say you know what? They're all pretty comparable. They all have their challenges. They all are consuming. They're different. But the one thing about them all, NBA free agency, and I really like this compared to what Schefter has in football, what Passan has in baseball, which their free agency is brutal because it drags out. Spring training starting.
It's still going. It's still going.
The one thing that I do love about NBA free agency is it's like largely over in 3 hours. I mean, right. like the deals are done for the most part. Like, I bet you 70% of them are done in 3 or 4 hours at night, 75. And then you might have one lingering. Is LeBron holding it up? Is Kawhi holding it up? Is Durant, Kyrie? But there's less great players don't really go into free agency anymore. They sign their max deals where they are, and then they just ask for trades. They go into portal. It's really, I call it the NBA trade portal, because I'm not going into free agency. I can make the most money by signing where I am and then asking out. And so I'm right. just going to go in the portal when I want to go in the portal. And wow. so
well, things have changed. By the way,
that's changed.
The other thing that's terrible about the draft, at least in years past, is you have to sit there and pretend like Jay Billis knows what he's talking about. I mean, come on.
Don't say that. Jay knows what he's talking about.
I know. Jay's a friend of ours and been on the show a few times, and we have he's an unbelievable storyteller.
He's incredible. I love working with that guy. I love, especially around the draft. I get to work with him, and he's a unique guy. I'm a big Yeah, big Jay Billis.
You've got to ask him for some Bob Knight stories. He has got some unbelievable.
I've heard a couple.
Yeah,
I've
they're great. They're just great.
I've heard a couple.
Woj, do you ever get to just sit down and watch an entire basketball game and enjoy yourself? Or is that just...
I'm going to watch one at, what are we, what is it, 5:16 right now, yes. Eastern?
Let me guess, St. Bonaventure playing?
Loyola Chicago in the Riley Center. They're on a 7-game winning streak. They're what, 11-2 in the league?
They're good.
It's a big
Valentine.
One. Good.
Valentine's a good coach.
Good coach. And, you know, their athletic director, Steve Watson's a good friend of mine. He was at St. Bonaventure. He was the coach who hired Mark. He was the athletic director who hired Mark Schmidt.
Oh, wow.
At St. Bonaventure and saved our program. And Steve's dad was a longtime provost sort of at Bonaventure. And Steve played at Rutgers and then Bowling Green for Jim Larrañaga. And so I was just texting with him today about the game, asking if maybe he could get the bus lost or something, and they wouldn't show up. No, so I will be watching that. Hopefully Great. Nothing will disturb me when that's happening. But those are the 2 hours if I can watch us. I saw two games during the All-Star break. I bolted Indy on Saturday morning. I got back for like a Bonnie Davidson game, and then that Wednesday – I drove to Philly and watched us get drilled by LaSalle, which was not great. But
yeah, well,
that's being team. A fan.
Yeah.
Woj, we can't thank you enough for giving us this time. We're big fans of yours.
You guys are awesome. This is a lot of fun. I really appreciate it.
We love everything you do. When we see your name come across the scroll or on a notification or a tweet, we know we got to pay attention. So it's really been great catching up with you and hearing your story a bit and just your take on things. Thanks so much for doing it, and keep up the great work.
Eric Ward, great to be with you guys, and this was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me on.
That was our guest. That was our guest.
I love how normal he seems.
Totally.
You know, he's Clark Kent, and his Superman is the Woj Bomb. I mean, like, it's so – he's just such a normal dude.
I just don't understand how, with the thousands of relationships – He has to maintain his pulse, his finger on the pulse of every single thing going on of any significance in the NBA. How in the hell do you take an hour to talk to us? I would just say no to begin with if I was him. But two, I would be like, there would at least be 37 texts or phone calls I would need to take along the way. But like that is really remarkable to me, because I cannot chew gum and walk at the same time for this guy to be running this incredible empire, really, that he's created with breaking news in the NBA. How can you take an hour, like a full hour, and just do something like this? It's remarkable.
More than an hour, almost an hour and a half.
God bless.
Or hour and 15. I will tell you the other thing that I'm interested in, the phone. This has been a constant source of conflict for me with Holly recently, because I am always on the phone. I have it with me. I'm tweeting something. I'm reading a tweet. I'm responding to a message board post. You've seen it.
Holly and I have seen you tweet in your sleep, dude. It's crazy.
Yes, you have. And while that used to be funny for Holly, it is no longer funny.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've tried to like find the balance, but for Woj, it is his life's blood. I mean, it is his life's work.
Yeah,
is the phone.
Holly would be more understanding if you had over 6 million Twitter followers.
You mean the 19K doesn't do it? Yes. Well, look, man, it's a departure for us, but I love there's a little couple intersections of Indiana in there, you know, and relationships with Dusty May. And obviously he's a basketball guy. So he clearly has known of Indiana and it's played some role in his basketball life. But I just love hearing guys that are in this basketball world that we love. I know there's a lot of people that listen to this that don't love the NBA, but I have to say, just like you follow Rabbi just ravenously during recruiting season and any update, you want any comment, that's what it's like for NBA fans of every NBA team of all 30 to follow Woj. You are just desperate. What is Woj going to say? And when you see Adrian Wojnarowski reporting, you want to know, is it going to be my team? What is it? And he is just so well regarded by everybody. Yeah, I just love him. I love him. Great dude.
I'm glad that Jay Billis came up, because I try to make Annie understand the magnitude of some of our guests. And, you know, Twitter followers is a good way to help.
Yeah, Annie's in talent. She gets social media footprint.
But when you know, talking about Jay Billis being as highly regarded as anybody when it comes to commenting, analyzing, speaking on college basketball, and that's where Woj is with the NBA. Like there's nobody who has a bigger following, who makes a bigger impression, that has more people paying attention to them than Woj in the NBA game, just like Billis in the college game. And it's just a total, it's really like, I got to pinch myself that these gentlemen have both taken time to come on here and talk basketball.
Yeah, because let's be honest, us asking Woj to be on our Jay Billis is really no different than you asking Marv Albert to talk to you. It's really no different. It's just two idiots who have nothing to offer these guys, that they're just doing us a favor and paying it forward. It's our make-a-wish. That's what it is.
Yeah, we are both very special, and they recognize that. And they're
that might be how we get interviews. People just take pity. By the way, I do want to say on the Woj versus Billis thing, it's funny because I agree with you on their places in their respective leagues, if you will,
yeah,
but for totally different reasons. Billis is about his opinion. That's why he's built up a you know, reputation. It's his opinion on analyzing games or state of the game. He's been very vocal about NIL and very vocal about the NCAA, and even court storming he's taken like a central, you know, place in.
And
whereas
just,
Woj and is just, not opinion.
Well, and even his in-game commentary, right?
But again, that's opinion, yeah. Right? Yeah. That's opinion. Mm-hmm. Whereas Woj is the opposite. It's very short. I wish we could have gotten into more like, what does he enjoy more? Did he enjoy the writing process of the book? And does he feel frustrated that now he doesn't really get to write as much? When there's a big story like the Lakers-Warriors potential trade for LeBron, then he gets to flex his writing muscle. But he's mostly writing in 140 characters.
Yeah.
You know, but for Woj, it's just facts. You know that if he says something, it's credible and it's about news breaking. And Jay Billis isn't in that game. But you're right. They are the guys. It's like, that's who they are. It's like Bob Costas used to be that, I think, for baseball. You know, Howard Cosell years before. But these guys are the most prominent media personalities in their sports. And Woj has just carved out this unbelievable niche of other guys who break news defer to Woj. Like, they don't even compete, really. Like, Brian Windhorst and those other guys, they just know he's the GOAT. He is the GOAT. So, yeah, really fun to chop it up with him.
And it is one where, and we talked to Rabbi about this, of you just have to be so honest and have so much integrity and such a commitment to being right, to being correct. And it's you don't get to be Woj without just having an amazing amount of respect. you know, both that you provide to your contacts and that your contacts reciprocate to you. Like, without that mutual respect and trust and honesty and commitment to getting things right, you don't get into that position. So I think it just speaks so highly as to who he is as a human being that he's gotten to the place he has.
Yeah, totally agree. Really appreciate him coming on. As always, follow us on Twitter at Hoosier Hysterics for the hysterics. No E.
No I.
But the sometimes way.
And then you're going to have to put in somebody else because we forgot to. I can't even imagine explaining that to Woj. I think we would just hear click at the end.
We're done now.
All right. Well, we'll see you next week.
Bye.
From the halls of assembly, you'll hear a screaming shout. Our love of Indiana is manic and devout. Everything I do, we discuss in unique manner. We won't be satisfied until we hang another banner. Us two goofy guys go by names of Ward and Eric. And as you probably know by now, we're Hoosier Hysterics. Hoosier